are listening to From the Margins on CHSR 97.9. Infinity.
Aggressive state intervention into the local labor movement that ensures that the radical labor movements are marginal.
What they're looking for now is less to get elected and more to come to the favorable attention of capital.
For the first time in history, we have a movement in this country led by indigenous peoples and most importantly, indigenous women.
Repeatedly, we've seen the attempt to criminalize black victims, to do anything to smear their names, to basically imply that black life isn't worth anything.
Our society teaches women to be ashamed of their bodies, to hate their bodies, to change their bodies.
We see increasing organized repression.
I'm stubborn. I'm not going to back down. This could go on for years and years and years.
People need to realize what type of struggle that they're on.
The police, of course, are going to believe that there's some kind of criminal reason behind this.
Take every day as an act of resistance, whether it was a strike, a riot, or whatever.
It's very difficult for people to engage in sustained dissent. I don't believe it's impossible, though.
Hello, and it's back to a new... almost choking on an oat cake. It's it is back to some new show content, finally, on From the Margins here. After a summer of being away out west in Calgary, I'm back in the so-called captain's chair here, ready to give some new content. Got some really awesome stuff for today. So this past week, there was an interesting incident that took place at the meeting of the UNB Senate, the University of New Brunswick Senate, which takes care of the academic side of governance at UNB. And the first piece is going to be an interview I did with Julian Renaud, who is the student senator who asked this question, who intended to ask a question, I should say, but due to circumstances, that didn't happen. And then the next piece on the show is going to be about the largest prison strike in the history of the United States, which has like zero media coverage, at least in the mainstream, on it. And I interviewed Jordan House, who's a PhD student at York University, who is studying prisoner labor and has been following this strike and had some thoughts to say about what's going on, as well as ways to read it and how it may relate to Canada. All right, so we're just going to kick right into that now. Here is, first off, Julian Renaud on the incident at the UNB Senate this past week.
My name is Julian Renaud. I am an elected student senator at UNB and a third-year law student.
Recently, there was the first UNB Senate meeting of the academic year. And you, as a student senator, were at that meeting, and you had intended to ask a question, but something happened and this didn't occur.
At the September 13th, 2016 meeting of the UNB Senate, I had submitted a question before the meeting relating to the president's midterm review, which the board had voted to approve in the winter of 2016. And that question got a written reply in the Senate meeting materials. And then when we got to the meeting, I was asked if I had any follow-up questions about the response to my original question. And I did, but I said that I don't believe it would be appropriate for the president to chair the meeting while we discuss these follow-up questions, because the subject matter is the president's job review and employment contract. And in fact, in a previous meeting of Senate in May, the president stepped out of the room and the vice president academic took over as chair of the meeting while his midterm review was being discussed. And really, that is standard operating procedure, not just in universities, but in any context, really. If you're in a meeting and your job review is being discussed, then obviously, you step out. You know, that's a personnel issue. You can't chair a meeting where, you know, your job performance is being discussed. So the president responded to that in, frankly, a very defensive and petulant way. And he refused to leave the room. He just dug his heels in. He glared at me for the longest time and refused to leave. It's as if he took it a slight against him that I said that he shouldn't chair the meeting for that, which it wasn't. I just wanted to follow the regular operating procedure of the Senate so that we could discuss the matter openly and frankly. But he refused to leave, so I couldn't ask the questions that I had. So we couldn't conduct all of the Senate's business because the president refused to leave as he was supposed to do.
Do you think the president had an awareness that there were rules that he was ignoring?
Oh, I'm sure he did, because like I said, he stepped out in the May meeting of Senate when we talked about this. He stepped out in the board meeting. I was also a member of the Board of Governors last year when we voted to approve this midterm review, and he stepped out of the meeting before we did that. So he's well aware that it's regular operating procedure, that if your own job review is being discussed, you have to leave the room while it's being discussed. And you can come back in after that discussion has ended, but you can't be there while it's being discussed. So it's very odd the way he acted. He just got irrational and wasn't conducting himself appropriately.
So what were you going to ask him?
Well, I was going to ask the secretary about the nature of the midterm review, because when we voted for the midterm review at board, it was well understood amongst myself and the other members of the board who voted for this midterm review that it was to be a regular job review, which if we found that it was not in the best interests of UNB to continue to employ Dr. Campbell as its president, that we would get a new candidate for the presidency and terminate Eddie Campbell's contract and pay him off, because his contract stipulates we would have to pay him a significant sum of money to get rid of him, but that's pretty standard. So it was well understood that that would be the process, especially since that's the process that's used to review the vice presidents. When a vice president is under review, it's well understood. If their job performance isn't satisfactory and it would be best to get a new vice president, that's what happens. But the problem with this midterm review is that the board committee that was struck to actually write the terms of reference for the review, frankly, they acted against the will of the board because they drew the terms of reference so narrowly that terminating the president's contract isn't an option. They've said that this midterm review isn't a standard job review. It's simply a way to provide feedback to the president on his performance so that he can do it better for the rest of his term, which is about another 2 years. So I was concerned about that because I don't think it's a legitimate process the way that the terms of reference are drawn up, because it's not what we voted for, frankly. It just diverges from the will of the board too much that I don't think it's a legitimate process, and the Senate is being asked to participate in it, as are other major stakeholders at UNB.
So is there any way that Mr. Campbell could have any idea of what you were going to ask him? Was there any record of your intended question at all?
There is no record of my intended question. However, he may have seen where it was going, because he knew that I was a member of the board, and he knew that I voted to have a midterm job review of him. And he saw my original question was, what are the terms of reference of the president's midterm review? Because I had heard rumors that they had been watered down to the point where terminating the president's contract was no longer an option. So I was concerned about that rumor, so I wanted to get verification of it. So he probably saw the writing on the wall and knew where I was going with it. And if that's the case, he certainly doesn't want that being brought out in public, that, you know, the midterm review committee is essentially trying to protect him by giving us a process that can't possibly terminate his employment with UNB.
You're a student senator, and you ask this question. Do you feel that the reason that one of the reasons why Mr. Campbell chose to stay around and not recuse himself from that meeting was because you're a student senator?
That's also entirely possible. At the May meeting of Senate, it was a professor, Dr. Norman Betts, who asked the questions relating to the president's midterm review and who had, in fact, submitted an agenda item about it. And at that point, the president had no problem recusing himself when asked to do so. He left, and the vice president academic at the time, which was Jane Fritz, took the chair. And that's right in the meeting minutes. So that's entirely possible, because he's recused himself every time a professor asked him to. But now that a student asked him to, he refused. The thing is, he does have a history of not dealing well with students. He doesn't seem to like to be questioned by students. Even when I was at the board, he actually blew up on me in a board committee meeting because I had proposed a couple amendments to the board rules of order that would have made the Board of Governors more transparent. And he really didn't like that, and he actually yelled at me right in a committee meeting. He never did that with any other members of the board. Oh, and the other student board member, he also yelled at him, but it was only the students that he dealt with in that manner.
So there was another, was it a student senator or a student member of the board that also seemed to face some lack of respect, in your opinion, from Mr. Campbell?
Absolutely. It's been several students. One was a student member of the board and a student senator, like myself. And there were two other student senators, my predecessors, actually, who got a similar dressing down from President Campbell when they were asking questions of him in Senate 2 years ago. So it's been a pattern, and I'm not the only one who has noticed it.
What do you think is going to happen now in the aftermath of this incident? How do you think that those in the Senate will respond? How will students respond? What do you think is going to happen?
I think that at least two things will happen. One, there's going to be a pushback against the job review terms of reference as they've been drawn up, because it's well understood that this is not what the board intended to do when it voted to approve this midterm review. It intended to have a process that would ensure that the best candidate to lead UNB forward as its president is in the president's seat. And if President Campbell isn't the ideal candidate, then we should get somebody who is. So there's going to be pushback against that, especially given that three members of Senate are also members of the board, or were members of the board. I was a member of the board, but there's two who still are and are still senators. And we were there when we voted for it, so we know firsthand what we intended. So there will be pushback against the process, first of all. And second of all, whatever the midterm review ends up being, whatever the process ends up being, the president's interaction with students will be one of the issues that will be brought up. Because, as I mentioned, he has a history of not dealing positively with students. And it's very important that a university president deals well with students, given that students are the vast majority of the people in the university community. And, frankly, it's very important for students to get involved with university politics and make sure that the student voice is heard and that student concerns are addressed. And what I've seen is that all too often students are very silent in Senate meetings and so forth. And it doesn't help when the moment that a student speaks up, the president has a tendency to try to shut them down. You know, there were four other student senators in the room when Dr. Campbell basically went after me in Senate on Tuesday. And none of them said anything for the rest of the meeting. Perhaps those two things are related. There definitely needs to be an improvement in relations between the president and the student body.
So that was Julian Renaud, who is a student member of the University of New Brunswick Senate. And his discussion of what happened at the meeting this past week. So basically, as he was recounting, as was normal procedure, he expected the president to leave the room when his own job review was being talked about. And Mr. Renaud wasn't the only one concerned about this. So here's a letter that was from Professor Eula Hughes, who was at that same meeting, was sent to the board chair and the chair of the review committee. And this letter expressing her concerns, which was posted on the Take Back UNB Facebook page, is as follows. Dear Mr. Baxter, dear Ms. Hoyt, President's treatment of student senator. I'm writing to express my concern over the conduct of President Campbell at yesterday's, so this was referring to the day after the meeting. The letter was written the day after, obviously. I'm writing to express my concern over the conduct of President Campbell at yesterday's Fredericton Academic Senate meeting. This was my first Senate meeting after a 3-year hiatus. The change in tone in the interim was remarkable, and I am sorry to say that it was not a change for the better. This would not have prompted me to write, however, but for the hostile and degrading treatment of one of the student senators during question period. The student senator had submitted a question to the university secretary in advance of the meeting and was given the opportunity to ask a follow-up question. Since the topic of the question was the board's midterm review of the president, the student not unreasonably queried whether it was appropriate for the president to preside over the meeting while the follow-up question was being presented. The president's facial expression is difficult to describe. If looks could kill, there would have been casualties. After clearly struggling to regain his composure, the president asked the secretary for advice. She commented that, without knowing the substance of the question, she was unable to determine whether the president or anyone else in the room would be able to answer it. I intervened to suggest that the student's question was about whether the president should recuse from the chair and not about whether he was the best person to answer a question. The secretary then advised that she felt it was in the president's discretion. A long and very uncomfortable silence ensued. Then President Campbell stared at the student and stated that he had been asked to leave the chair. After another lengthy presidential pause and more staring, the student asked, "And I take it the answer is no?" At that point, the president said, "Yes, I am not going to leave," or words to that effect. The student senator did not ask his follow-up question. Having been a university teacher for almost 2 decades, I thought I knew what would come next. I thought the president would conduct himself in the way any professor would. He would ask or encourage the student to ask the question. He would tell the student that it was perfectly fine to ask any question and that the president would endeavor to answer it. I could not have been more wrong. The president continued to stare at the student grimly and silently. Then the president proceeded to the next agenda item. I understand that performance reviews can be uncomfortable. I understand that people skills are not generally President Campbell's strong suit. But I do not think we can tolerate a situation where the students are treated in this manner. Senate is not the Spanish Inquisition. It is a key institution of collegial governance. The president has a professional obligation to interact with students in a manner that sets an example for all of UNB. Never is this more important than in a meeting where faculty, deans, directors, staff, and students come together to work towards making UNB the best it can be. Student senators should be appreciated for their willingness to contribute and volunteer their time and ideas. They are entitled to an environment that is conducive to the free exchange of ideas. they are entitled to respect as fellow human beings. None of this was on display yesterday. I would ask the chair to raise this concern with the president at your earliest opportunity, and would ask the chair of the review committee to take my comments into account as part of the feedback on the president's performance. If the president cannot interact properly with students, he is in the wrong job. This is true whether the student is acting properly or not, but I should emphasize that the student senator conducted himself entirely politely and appropriately throughout. Thank you very much for your continued and unwavering support of UNB. Please let me know if you would like to discuss this further. That was from Professor Eula Hughes, who was at that same meeting and witnessed the events. The letter was from September 14, 2016, and was published on the Take Back UNB Facebook page. Okay, so that's a wrap for that. And going to follow up on those events and see what happens down the road. I'm sure there will be more interviews, more commentary on this job review, and see what happens down the road. This could get interesting. All right, so next, going to take a song break. I was at a jazz festival show last night with the Phil Dwyer Trio and Dee Dee Bridgewater, two excellent jazz outfits last night. Excellent show. I'm going to play a track that wasn't played last night by Dee Dee Bridgewater, but I really like the song, and I'm always interested in different versions of it. This is Dee Dee Bridgewater with House of the Rising Sun.
A tailor, she sold me my new blue jeans. My daddy was a gambling man down in New Orleans. Seems to be satisfied is when he's laid down on the street dead drunk. Mama, tell your children, please don't do what I've done. Oh, don't spend your life in sin and misery in the house of the rising sun. Well, I've got one foot on the platform, the other foot is on the train. I am going back to I'm one.
That was the amazing Dee Dee Bridgewater with a cover of House of the Rising Sun. Cool. So that's that. And now next to Prisoner Labor. So right now in the United States, entering its second week, is the largest strike of prisoners in the country's history. These are specifically prisoners who work, so prisoner laborers. And this piece has introductory notes and all that in it, so I won't go into all these details. Here's Jordan House, PhD student at York University, who studies these subjects, talking about the prison strike in the States and what can we expect in terms of connections to Canada. All right, I'm speaking now with Jordan House, a PhD student at York University in Toronto, who is studying prisoner labor. Jordan, could you elaborate on what is the subject of your research first?
Sure. So I study prison labor and prisoner labor resistance in Canada. So I'm especially interested in attempts by prisoners, kind of in their capacity as workers, to better their conditions. So by forming unions or going on strike or otherwise agitating or taking collective action to improve their conditions.
So right now in the United States, we have entering its second week the largest prisoner labor strike in the history of the country. Could you give a sense of exactly how big this strike is?
Yeah, I think the short answer to your question is we don't know exactly how big it is yet. And it's going to be a while before we really do. But I guess the strike started on September 9th, which was the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising, a very famous American prison uprising. And based on that date, prisoners and outside support organizations in the States were organizing for several months to try to kick off a strike with the theme of ending prison slavery. And as your listeners may or may not know, the U.S. Constitution, the amendment that abolished slavery, has a provision which basically says slavery is abolished with the exception of those who've been duly convicted of a crime, meaning that many prisoners in the United States work for free. And so the goal of this strike was to abolish that as well as to meet demands that prisoners from different parts of the country are putting out. But what we know in short is that 29 prisons were involved, and basically that information comes from the number of facilities which went on lockdown in response to strike activity or because the administration thought there was going to be strikes. So we know that at least that many prisoners missed work. Undoubtedly there were hundreds or thousands of others who struck in facilities that didn't go on lockdown. And so those numbers, I think, are still being calculated right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Just the way you're describing the like how you're finding out about what's going on is sort of indirectly because of issues with getting information out from prisoners. I'm guessing this is a major challenge, is it?
Getting information out is always tricky, but prison administrators, I guess, either have to say or do say when facilities are on lockdown. So based on that, outside supporters, especially with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which is one of the organizations playing the strike, have been just like calling lists of prisons and trying to figure out if they were on lockdown or not, or still are.
You mentioned that there's a list of demands. So there's, for one, the issue of how prisoner laborers are basically slaves. And then there's a list of other demands. Do you happen to have some of those with you?
Off the top of my head, I know there's demands about medical treatment and especially copay. There's like very expensive copays. Before the strike kicked off, there was actually strike activity in Texas where this was one of the major demands, which was in order to see a doctor, there was a $100 copay per visit. So that meant, you know, essentially a strong disincentive to be able to see a doctor. And so that's one of the demands about better medical treatment, more accessible medical treatment. Others is around parole and probation, living conditions, quality of food, things like that.
So you're studying in particular this kind of a subject in Canadian prisons, basically prisoner laborers and their efforts to change conditions, their efforts to get paid, etc. So how can you look at what's happening in the States and relate it to Canada?
Yeah, there are comparisons. It's easy to connect to Canada. I mean, the major difference being, at least formally, there's no unpaid labor in Canadian prisons by prisoners. Prisoners won through strikes, basically, in the 1930s, pay for Canadian prisoners. But many of the same issues around dignity at work, and as well as conditions of work, including pay and compensation, also exist in the same way in Canada. And in fact, Canada had a federal prison strike in 2013, which was large, and prisons in Ontario, Quebec, Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, and maybe others that we don't know about, prisoners struck in response to the federal government cutting pay for federal industry programs. So that was a large strike here, and it kind of came on the heel as of the California hunger strikes, which happened in 2013. This has been kind of a continuous thing in the United States, this like ramping up of prison protests, and Canada has been involved in that, Canadian prisons and prisoners.
So has there been any uptake in Canadian prisons of the strike going on in the States? Like, is there any sign that, or any way that prisoners in Canada can find out and perhaps connect to it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't heard of anything happening in Canadian prisons in relation to the September 9th strike, but I mean, there has been stuff going on, in particular around immigration detention and hunger strikes by immigration detainees in Lindsay, Ontario, which has been ongoing for several years. And the Canadian prison strike never really ended. So, you know, there's some places where people have not been working since 2013.
And that's based on the demands not being met from back then?
That's right, yeah.
One of many very interesting things about the idea of a multi-prison strike, whether in the United States or Canada, is unlike outside of prisons where people can just communicate with each other by phone, by email, etc., you have obvious communication barriers between the prisons. How are prisoners able to coordinate strikes between prisons, so multi-prison strikes?
Right. Well, with the proliferation of cell phone technology, it becomes, you know, increasingly possible for prisoners to get access to communication through informal channels. And that means, you know, they could talk to outside supporters, they could talk to people in other facilities. But there's a major role that's played by the outside support organizations. And so, in particular, organizing this strike was really anchored by the Free Alabama Movement, which is a group of prisoners in Alabama in state prisons who have been extremely militant, struck several times over the last few years. And the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which is a committee of the Industrial Workers of the World, which has solicited membership of prisoners across the United States and helped organize and coordinate the strike. And a major part of that was obviously serving as a tool for people to communicate between facilities.
So we're talking about right now, the strike in the U.S. is, I believe, entering its second week. And it sounds like from what you're saying that it looks to be growing. What can be expected from this strike? What's your thought on
on what could end up happening? Is it possible that they could finally challenge that a constitutional issue with the prisoners effectively being slaves?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I hope so. But, you know, one thing to note that's coming out now, I guess, yeah, over a week in to the strike is the lack of, you know, U.S. mainstream media attention to this at all. So that's obviously a weakness and something that if this is going to become a major issue and a mainstream issue in the United States, there's going to have to be some way of getting the message out to people. And, you know, hopefully the media will start picking it up. Otherwise, support organizations and alternative media have been doing a great job at trying to report what's been going on.
Have you noticed anything in Canadian mainstream media? Any coverage at all?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, the 2013 prison strike in Canada did have some mainstream coverage. There was, you know, several CBC articles, but I'm not really sure what the answer is to how do you get your strike to breach over into, you know, mainstream consciousness.
Right. So what, do you have any further thoughts on what people outside could do in any way if they're interested in somehow supporting these strike efforts and finding ways to assist the strikers in meeting their demands?
Yeah, there's lots of ways. And so one thing to do is follow along and stay educated about what's going on. And the best way to do that is through, I guess, online, through the Incarcerated Worker Organizing Committee website, which is IWOC, IWOC.noblogs.org, as well as itsgoingdown.org, which has a really useful roundup of report backs of what's been happening day by day. And people can also support the strike with their wallets. You can donate to IWOC or the Free Alabama Movement. There's also volunteer work to be done. You can get in touch with IWOC. Like I said, there's especially a need for people to be calling prisons and figuring out if they're on lockdown or not. And people can also just talk to their friends and families about what the strike is and why it's happening and why it's important.
Well, thanks a lot, Jordan, for your thoughts.
Cool. Thank you.
All right, that was Jordan House, PhD student at York University in Toronto, who studies prison labor, efforts of prisoner workers to try and improve their conditions. And this whole show is going to be posted onto the From the Margins website as soon as I can deal with the technical details. But for now, we're going to go to some more music. So I mentioned last night I was at this awesome jazz festival. I call it Jazz Festival. Harvest Jazz and Blues in Fredericton. So I lived in Halifax and they call it the Halifax Jazz Fest. Sorry. So, the Harvest Jazz and Blues. I was at a show last night featuring Phil Dwyer Trio and Dee Dee Bridgewater. So I played a Dee Dee Bridgewater song now. Here is a Phil Dwyer Trio song, Old Cowhand. Thank you.
Thank you.